Hello and happy repeal day. I am Peter Suderman, features editor at Reason Magazine. I am here with Jarrett Dieterle to celebrate the anniversary of the end of Prohibition. Jarrett is the director of commercial freedom policy and a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, where he edits drinksreform.org, which advocates for better alcohol policies. He is also the author of a new report on America's dumbest drinking laws, which we're going to talk about a little later today. Jarrett, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk booze.
Yeah, me too. So we're going to talk about Prohibition, how it came about, what it was like, why it ended, and how it sort of still lingers with us today. But I actually first want to start just by asking you about you and about your job. And so Reason is a nonprofit. We have a foundation that's sort of a more traditional think tank arm. I have interviewed, interacted with, and friends with many people who hold senior fellow titles at think tanks here in Washington. I don't think I have ever encountered or even heard of one before who studies booze law. Right. So can you tell me just a little bit about what you do and sort of how this position was conceived and how it came about?
Yeah, yeah. No, I sometimes have to pinch myself that I always wanted to work at a think tank and I got to do booze at a think tank. So I feel very lucky. But yeah, basically our R Street Drinks program was actually started by my boss, Kevin Kosar, has written a couple books on whiskey and moonshine and always had this real interest in distilled spirits. And he came to R Street several years before me and looked around the free market landscape and said, hey, no one's talking about alcohol policy. There's some of the most croniest, protectionist, outrageous laws in need of reform in this market probably as much as any other. So he's like, we might as well dig into this. And so we did. And I even before our street days, I got into writing kind of freelance booze policy stuff. I moved from Michigan, my home state, to go to college in Virginia. And I remember the first time we made a booze run in college. We went to we had to go to an ABC store. And I was just abhorred that such a thing even existed because I didn't have those in Michigan. And so I got interested in writing about it. And when I came to R Street,
so you would, this was like your college major, like your shadow college major was booze policy.
Research.
This
is right. Yeah.
You studied this in college, maybe not formally.
Yeah, exactly. Studying might be a generous term, but I got more and more into it and fascinated by it. And Virginia just has so many crazy laws that living there, once I kind of moved to the D.C. area, just made it kind of a natural thing to start writing about. So we kind of have just taken the ball and run with it from there at R Street. We started a website which tries to aggregate all of the kind of bad alcohol laws and reform efforts for those alcohol laws across the country. And there's no shortage of stuff to write about. There's, just so many absurd laws that really hurt spirits entrepreneurs and then also consumers, particularly.
Much of your job do you spend drinking? And for the purposes of listeners right now, we're taping this at 11 a.m. And what are you currently drinking?
Yeah, straight vodka here. No, just a glass of water. But if it was a couple hours later, maybe we'd dip into the good stuff. But it's actually cool. So I get to actually go to things like Tales of the Cocktail, for example, the big drinks conference in New Orleans, and got to taste a ton of different awesome cocktails down there, and ended up kind of writing about kind of the craft spirits boom and how we have this amazing jobs engine basically in our country that I think a lot of ways is being overlooked, and kind of what the policy implications are around that. But yeah, so I get to do a lot of day drinking, night drinking, whatever. It's one of the benefits of the job, I guess.
So just to actually hook off what you're talking about the jobs engine of the cocktail industry, maybe we'll talk about that specifically a little bit later. But I actually want to start by going back a little while, maybe even a long while, to pre-prohibition here. And prior to Prohibition, actually prior to the Civil War, in many states, the alcohol production was one of the biggest industries, one of the biggest job creators. Whiskey production in particular was a big deal. And whiskey consumption, we were just talking about this, whiskey consumption was really quite significant. At times in the 1800s, it was, I have heard, on average for adult men in the United States, about a half a pint, that's 8 ounces per day, which means that it would have been quite common to have people even drinking, to have men drinking even more than that, so 10, 12, even 16 ounces of whiskey a day. And that, I think, is a sort of a good segue into kind of how the movement towards prohibition got started. So right. prohibition didn't start until 1920. Mm-hmm. The 18th Amendment that ratified, that passed prohibition was passed in 2 years before that. Mm-hmm. But the movement started decades prior. Can right. you talk just a little bit about the forces that came about that helped shape and that helped make prohibition possible?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're right to hit upon early America, even dating back to colonial era, had a really rich spirit-making heritage and culture. George Washington's the most prolific example, just because he was president, so everyone knows him, but he was kind of one of our first whiskey tycoons that was making rye whiskey right down in Mount Vernon. And early Americans love, hard cider was a huge thing. John Adams would have a gill of it every day for breakfast, which is one of my favorite stories. There was all these what now we would probably call micro distilleries, like all over the country, that were just people running their own stills, and there was a lot of creativity and, obviously a lot of different varieties.
And sometimes they would like sell, but often it was like you would run a still just for yourself.
Yeah,
you
for
would
yourself.
Just, women who stayed home would make beer
right.
just for their family and their farm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that eventually, morphed over time. And as you well know, you wrote kind of the foundational article on it. It led to this amazing craft cocktail culture, which really took off in the pre-prohibition era. And there was I'm not going to explain it to you because you know more about it than I do. So then around the couple decades before. Prohibition, as you said, there started to be a little bit of a cultural sea change in a lot of ways. There was the temperance movement, which started gaining hold, and religious revivalism that started kind of spreading across the nation. There was a real concern about the underclass in America, about immigrants, about amongst the progressive forces, and there's kind of this desire to better society in a way, and kind of all these forces glommed on to alcohol as kind of this blame all instead of like a cure all, blame all of a lot of societal ills. There was concerns about husbands spending the weekly wages down at the bar, spending more time at the speakeasy than they were with the family, that the lower class couldn't handle their alcohol, and it was kind of acting as a ceiling on their economic process. Aspects. And just it's really amazing when you look back at prohibition era newspapers. When I was down in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail, I was looking at old Times Picayune newspapers, and it's amazing all the things they expected prohibition to do. It was just this whole list of how the world would be wonderful, and everyone would middle class and lower class would get all these jobs, and it would be such this wonderful utopia. But it was kind of this desire amongst kind of religious temperance groups and progressive groups to kind of better society that started, I think, taking hold and leading us down the road to prohibition, which started at the local and state level first, as you know, and
right.
It wasn't until 1920 that officially got federalized, but well before that, Virginia, for example, created their local option so counties could ban booze if they wanted to, and then the state of Virginia as a whole did, and then the national government did, and a lot of states kind of followed that train down the road to prohibition.
So I want to sort of ask you about the immigrant angle, which I think is important, in some of the ways that it reflects some of our political debates today, which is that a lot of prohibition the temperance movement was about kind of a Protestant evangelical sort of people who thought of themselves as real Americans being upset with immigrant newcomers who drank a lot more and thinking that they had a kind of low moral character and that if you stopped them from drinking, that would that would change them into, sort of good, right, upstanding Americans. But it really strikes me, sort of looking at some of the history of all of this, that that alcohol was the culture war in the 1800s, and that in the culture wars we think of now, in many ways predate, sort of go back to the alcohol fights, and sort of the assumption that immigrants were somehow lesser and different, and that that their drinking habits and drinking patterns were part of that.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned sort of the ways that prohibition started piecemeal in advance in the states beforehand. So there were a bunch of states and even in some states that were technically wet, there were a bunch of counties that were dry prior to prohibition. How did that kind of influence and set the stage for Prohibition to happen?
Yeah, those are all kind of good things to trace through the early Prohibition history. It actually, speaking of kind of immigrant populations and minority populations in the culture wars back at that time, when Virginia voted as a state to decide to have statewide Prohibition, for the most part, African Americans and white working class people didn't really vote in that actual election that they had. So it's, and a lot of them were more favorable, frankly, towards booze than, as you said, kind of this idea of like this, Puritan kind of mindset that a lot of the upper class.
I mean, there was also a divide with Catholics, right?
Like, yes,
Catholics
were
quite wet. And Catholics, sort of northern urban Catholics, also liked the fact, first of all, they were personally wet, but they also liked the fact that alcohol was a huge revenue raiser for state and local governments.
Yep. No, yeah, and it still is in a lot of ways. I think that, when this kind of first became a thing, obviously it's always easier to organize oftentimes on the local level than it is the national level. And so it started spreading across, as I said, some, local counties would become dry and then eventually states would. And, I think that it was just the beginning of a powerful, unfortunately powerful cultural force that kind of started spreading across the country and started, at the local level and worked its way up to the national level. And it didn't really, obviously, we can talk more about this, but it didn't really work anywhere, as we know, with federal prohibition. But I think there was kind of the idea that, if you keep leveling up, like eventually you'll kind of like get to the point where, oh, we have no booze anymore. Because if you only do a county, then it's even easier for a black market to operate, obviously, because you can run stuff into it and out. And I think the idea, if you kind of keep going, that eventually they would get to the point where if the feds were involved, then they'd really be able to kind of put a stop on booze throughout the country. And that was a spectacular miscalculation, as we know now.
And there was also a wartime prohibition prior to sort of what we think of as prohibition, that limited beer producers from, I believe it was they were stuck with like 2.5 or 2.75 ABV, right? It was sort of about a third or a half a down from what, sort of the normal alcohol by volume, which beer tends to be sort of in the 4-6% range.
Right.
And so part of, I think, what sort of my sense is that part of what led to prohibition and made it possible was that in many places it already existed.
Yes.
And so it happened gradually, even though it was in some sense a big overnight shift that happened on a national level. It happened gradually, kind of from the bottom up as a local movement first.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, people, I think, just tend to look at prohibition as the first time that we experimented with banning, booze from a population. And that, I actually just wrote about it in the law, actually just thankfully got repealed. But in the, 1834, Andrew Jackson signed what basically was prohibition for Native Americans. They weren't basically allowed to produce or sell spirits on Indian reservations. It didn't work at all because the government at that point was literally supplying U.S. soldiers who were supposed to kind of guard the things with like a government daily ration of whiskey. That was like what they did. And then they would trade it to the Native Americans. So it didn't work at all.
So there was prohibition and then black markets happened?
Yes. Yeah, right.
With U.S. government soldiers?
Right. Well, and then, as you said, during wartime, the Civil War, there was the South in particular, resources were such a premium for them that they didn't want like wheat and stuff to go to whiskey making. So they basically tried to ban it and say, hey, you need to like feed our populace basically and the soldiers with the wheat. But the soldiers did it anyways. They distilled, obviously, because they were in camps and bored. If you look at the whole history of military and booze in the U.S., it's kind of another whole fascinating rabbit hole about how that's evolved over time from Washington having daily rum rations during the Revolutionary War, up through much later in our history. But anyway, so we had these kind of islands or experiments of prohibition before national prohibition. None of them worked, but I agree that I think that at least put the idea in people's heads and made them, realize that this was a policy option, and then it kind of just spread like wildfire, really, from there.
It was a thing they could do so they could ratchet it up. And in 1918, Congress did pass the 18th Amendment, which was then ratified actually quite quickly. It proved to be unexpectedly popular, even more than the backers thought, with the states. It was quite popular, and so in 1920, prohibition goes into effect, and that's it. Everybody stops drinking, right?
Yeah.
There's no more drinking after that, and it was just it was fine. People were like, "Wow, this worked." It was more popular and worked better than we expected. So tell us what it was like, what drinking was like under prohibition, and what some of the effects were during that time.
Yeah. So, you know, again, this is stuff that, you've certainly researched as much as I have. But, you know, almost immediately when you ban a product that throughout human history, humans have wanted and desired, being alcohol, you create almost immediately an illicit market for it. You know, I mentioned my colleague Kevin wrote a history of moonshine, and it's not just an American thing. Like anywhere where the government has tried to put up like intense barriers, whether it's in, you know, very religious Muslim countries, for example, with alcohol, almost immediately there's a black market reaction to it. And you see that everywhere. So it was no different here. And anyone that understood economics would have been able to tell you that. But sure enough, it happened here. And essentially, it was driven underground. So it took multiple forms in the urban environments, right? You'd have the you know, famous speakeasies where, you know, people would go and have these kind of cocktail dens where they could illicitly drink. And then, of course, a lot of the production took place in more rural places. The Appalachian region, of course, became very famous for it because they also had a lot of history with alcohol. A lot of them were Scotch-Irish people that, you know, came to America and swapped barley for corn, started making bourbon.
I mean, the urban-rural divide is really interesting, and yeah, I think sort of an often overlooked part of this, which is that booze was made in the country and then consumed in cities.
Yeah.
And because you had to have a distribution pipeline, you had to, you ended up, the producers ended up having to kind of join conglomerates, conglomerates of illegal activity.
Yeah.
What does that sound like? They basically had to join up with the mob, which was responsible for sort of going around and collecting all this stuff, producing, not producing it, but doing the distribution and the movement.
Yeah.
And sort of you had all of these things spring up, like you would have drivers and cars who were just sort of basically, they were there to get arrested because it was much better to get sort of a driver who and a car to get a driver arrested who had no sort of connection to the rest of the industry, a car that was like you could lose a car. What you can't lose is a whole farm and a still. Which if you were the farmer, you could lose your whole farm and your still if you were picked up by the cops. And so it created all of these kind of black market distribution workarounds that enabled in some cases quite large organizations. That were working totally outside of the law, totally outside of the tax system. And of course, because they were working outside of the law, did not obey the law.
Right. No, that's exactly right. One of the big kind of trafficking places I don't think people realize today was Roanoke, Virginia, right? It was one of the big cities in the southwest corner of Virginia. There was a ton of booze making. Franklin County, Virginia was called the moonshine capital of the world. At one point, they estimated that 99 out of every 100 residents in the county was somehow involved in the illicit moonshine trade during Prohibition. And so
that sounds like a fun county.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, Matt Bondurant actually wrote Wettest County in the World. It's a historical novel about that era and about that county. If you want a look into what rural moonshining culture was during Prohibition, it's there. And you're absolutely right. So these guys operated outside of the law, became the law in some ways. A lot of them paid off the local sheriff. The sheriff knew full well he would just extort a fee from them to be able to ship.
There were states and counties, but even whole states where there was a kind of, let's call it, quasi-organized, semi-formal resistance, where the governor, the legislature, they were all wet. They thought Prohibition was stupid.
Yep.
And part of the way that Prohibition was organized, if I understand correctly, was that there was a sort of dual police power between the federal government and the states, so that on the one hand, states that wanted to enforce it could.
Right.
On the other hand, states that were like, we're probably not going to do that.
Yeah.
The idea was that the federal government could step in and do that. And it was an unusual system of police enforcement where you actually had both of them sort of tackling the problem at the same time.
Yeah, and also some of the local state law people got kind of co-opted too by it, and they would become part of like the criminal syndicate basically. So I think there was also some idea that the feds could fix that and wouldn't be immune to those forces. But yeah, so people were, you know, from these rural communities, you know, running moonshine into you know, every big city basically in America. Washington D.C. was you know, pretty prolific for it itself, really. I mean, there was the famous guy in the green hat who would deliver the booze to the congressmen in Congress. One of the Times Picayune articles I read, there was literally a congressman that was caught with a leaking suitcase of booze, and he was one of like the biggest advocates for Prohibition at the national level. And like the newspapers, like, are you serious, dude? Like, you have like literally booze leaking out of your suitcase. So
it's ceremonial.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
There were all these carve-outs, right?
Yes,
I mean, there were religious exemptions, there were medicinal exemptions.
Right.
And so even sort of ignoring the black market, there were all of these kind of, let's call them gray market sort of ways to get booze if you wanted it through, you know, you had priests and rabbis who basically set up shop.
Yeah.
You had drug stores that were setting up that became dispensaries, basically.
Yeah.
And so it did reduce consumption, though, right? Do you have a sense of what the reduction in alcohol consumption was during Prohibition? I mean, it wasn't that consumption continued at exactly the same rates.
No, right. Yeah, and speaking of kind of exceptions, I once heard someone say the local pharmacy replaced the local bar in a lot of ways during Prohibition because, you know, again, there was a workaround if there was a medical hook into it. But yeah, I haven't, like, you know, recently looked at all the rates for consumption levels and stuff, but obviously pre-Prohibition, the rates were much higher than they have been in the aftermath of Prohibition. They're still higher than they are today, as we were talking about earlier. And so I think, you know, the question is to what kind of end is lower alcohol consumption a good in and of itself? And, you know, certainly for some people that are potentially addicts or suffering from alcohol disorders, you know, it can be. But, you know, for other people that can responsibly enjoy it, you know, we have to ask whether really using this kind of hammer to try to lower alcohol consumption rates is a good in and of itself, especially when it creates all these negative side effects that come into play and all this black market and really a very dangerous enforcement regime that we had during that era.
So related to that, one of the sort of arguments that I've made that I've heard is that if you look at the type, how consumption changed, people really shifted away from beer. Beer basically, it didn't quite disappear during Prohibition, but it became, it was very rarely consumed compared with prior to Prohibition.
Yeah.
And the reason is that if you want to drink, and it's illegal, you want the most hardcore sort
count.
Of, right? You want the stuff that matters, right? And so what happened was that consumption became basically more dangerous, right? And so as people switched to spirits and then started kind of pounding them when they had the, when they had the opportunity, if you are somebody who is potentially going to abuse alcohol, that is a much more dangerous way, I think.
Yep.
In addition to the fact that a lot of that booze was mixed with pretty nasty stuff, often wood alcohol,
that's
things
what
like
I was gonna
that.
Say.
There were hundreds of deaths in New York City from bad alcohol consumption because when you're getting it on the black market, there's no way to sort of, or there's not a great way, especially for people who aren't rich, to get high quality product that they can assume has basically been safely made.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a much more dangerous kind of consumption, even if there's overall less of it.
Yeah, it does. And you still see that today, as I mentioned earlier. You know, I'll see once a week an article from some rural village in India where, you know, 50 people die from some bad alcohol they had. And so, you know, yeah, the second that you're incentivizing people to kind of go off the grid and make their own kind of stuff, moonshine can be very dangerous if it's not made right. You know, as you said, if it's from wood alcohol. And so I think that we take that for granted now, right? Like, we can go into like any liquor store, any beer store, and get just a delicious whiskey or, like, you know, just like a really high rate like IPA. And
but even
just,
if you buy the super cheap stuff,
you
can assume that it has
quality.
Been made, like,
yes.
You can assume that it has been made safely, that, like, it's that is perfectly safe to have a sip or two.
Yeah, well, one of the big markets right now for alcohol companies is, you know, Budweiser in, like, Africa, for example. Like, just having a reliable beer that is not dangerous is incredible for those places because they don't have that, right? And so you're 100% right that it created crappier alcohol, more dangerous consumption habits. And also made less fun consumption habits, not to, like, trivialize it, but, you know, not only did it really impact cocktail culture during that era, but also certain categories of alcohol that were huge in pre-Prohibition America, cider, hard cider is probably the best example, was just decimated with Prohibition. And it's only been really recently that the craft cider movement has come back. I've been wanting to...
And that stuff is delicious.
I know. It's so good. I've been wanting to write a riff, actually, off your piece about how government killed the apple, because what's, like, amazing, we have these, like, you know, basic, like, crappy apples in the supermarket now that don't even taste good. And they're very different than what you make cider with, which is, like, the old spitter, like, sour apples and all the different varieties. And all those orchards, like, government agents, that's on record, and during Prohibition, federal agents would come and chop down orchards of apples because they assumed that people were basically making cider with them. And apple orchards take like 25 years to regrow. So it's the kind of thing that after Prohibition got repealed, like, all the orchard owners, like, eh, like, I'm not really going to spend the time to rebuild that and start making craft cider again. So it just decimated this whole kind of category of alcohol that we had after Prohibition. As you said, beer struggled a lot. There was a shift towards, you know, different kinds of spirits. And so I think that there's so many policy lessons to be learned from Prohibition that are unsurprising, but I think have not really been told as much as they probably should be.
So we have Prohibition, and it goes well about as well as you could expect Prohibition to go.
Yep.
Drinking gets worse; it gets more dangerous. There's a lot of criminality. I mean, really, a massive amount of criminality associated with it. The kind of the scale of the criminal enterprises when you read about it, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue per year in 1920s dollars, right? So we're talking about the equivalent of billion-dollar enterprises here in today's dollars.
Yeah.
And of course, there is not everyone likes that. Even people who are sort of sympathetic to the dry cause are not super are aware of kind of the crime and of the kind of some of these negative effects that are happening.
Yeah.
And so we get to the end of the decade and we start moving towards repeal. So.
Yep.
Talk just a little bit about how we got repeal and what happened the minute that repeal, the day that repeal went into effect.
Yeah, the oceans parted and the booze flowed happily ever after. Yeah,
and there's no need for any
right.
think tank senior fellows
I can
in
retire.
Booze studies.
This is amazing. No,
solved that in 1933.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I think that you're right. I mean, I think that, again, I found the most fascinating histories of Prohibition is the firsthand sources, the newspapers that were covering it at the time. And if you look at kind of how their coverage went from this, you know, wide-eyed optimism early on to later on, I think that as much as anything, it was just a fatigue and a concern with how dangerous and difficult and how much the enforcement was and how much crime was kind of incentivized by Prohibition that made people really wear thin on it. I mean, I do. Even after Prohibition, there were still temperance forces. There were still people that didn't view alcohol as a good thing for people to have. I thought it was very detrimental to society. But I think that there was a growing recognition amongst a lot of different forces in America that on the ground enforcement was basically a disaster. It was leading to corrupt public officials. It was leading to dangerous raids. It was leading to a lot of people dying. It was leading to criminal syndicates and large organized crime rising up. It really fueled organized crime, whether it was the mob or it was other forces both in the rural cultures and in the city. So I think there's a recognition that whatever the objectives of it, they had kind of failed on the facts and failed on the ground, and basically that was not the best way to try to control people's access to alcohol. Even some of the biggest teetotalers of the era, like John D. Rockefeller and stuff, they kind of came to a point where they're just like, I still think alcohol is really bad, but Prohibition's a mess. Like, we should repeal it. And so even the people that were, I think, originally for it grew to this recognition that it really didn't accomplish what it set out to. So it was repealed in the 21st Amendment. That's the thing that we celebrate today and go out and everyone cheers their glasses to Repeal Day, which obviously was a great thing. There's no question about it. What was interesting is kind of what came after it. And I think that's mostly what we are dealing with today, or kind of at least feeling some of the aftershocks of the immediate post-prohibition aftermath.
Yeah, so talk about the kind of couple decades, right? I mean, there's basically sort of 50 years of kind of policy evolution after Prohibition before, 50, 70 years before you kind of get to where we're at today.
Yeah.
Because what the end of Prohibition, what repeal did was it eliminated federal prohibition.
Yes. Yep.
And then it left a whole lot of control just to the states.
Right. No, that's exactly right. Yeah. I always tell people to, I went to law school, so being the textualist that I am, I always tell people to take out the text of the 18th Amendment and the 21st Amendment. And I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but you can look it up yourselves. I mean, they both basically say that, you can't transport or produce or import alcohol in the United States in the 18th, and the 21st Amendment says the same thing, but says you can't do that in violation of state laws. So it basically kind of took the federal government's power and essentially gave it to the state governments. A lot of states were dry states after that. We still have dry counties, right, in certain parts of America today. And so there was kind of a rush to regulate by the states and the local governments after the federal government kind of exited the booze business. And so the question became, what do we do now that the federal experiment with this, the national experiment, has failed? And again, Rockefeller was a very influential guy in this era. He kind of helped fund a book called Toward Liquor Control, which basically set up options for what states could do for a regulatory system for alcohol. And one of them was control states, where this actual state government wasn't responsible for retailing and wholesaling of alcohol. Another was kind of a licensing system, what today has come to be known as the three-tiered alcohol system that requires a mandated separation between the, you know, distillers and brewers, the people producing it, and the wholesaler level and the retail level.
So can you break those down just a little bit further individually? When you have state control, let's talk about, so I believe Pennsylvania is a a state control state.
In Virginia.
And there's a couple of, there's still a number of these today.
Yep.
What exactly does that mean for people trying to, in particular for people trying to buy booze?
So there's still, I think it's 17 states have some form of control of either the wholesale or retail level, and over a dozen states still have a retail level control states, which means that they essentially have to go to a government-run alcohol store to be able to buy their alcohol. So you see this in Pennsylvania, you see this in Virginia, or the kind of the two main examples I often use because people are often very familiar with them because it's so obvious that you're in kind of a government-run liquor store in both those states, particularly the Virginia ABCs.
They're like beautifully designed. Totally, they're
just
contemporary,
like an Apple store.
And the service is great.
They're kind of drab Soviet era like throwbacks that are pretty depressing places. The way it manifests itself for the consumers, they actually have to go to a government store where government employees that get government pensions and salaries sell them alcohol. And so what it often does is it almost you still have the private producers obviously in those states or from out of state that are making the actual booze product, but then when it goes through wholesale and retail, it's the state that's kind of running those operations, and of course taking what is usually a huge markup on the side while they're doing it. That's why the states that have control systems have had so much trouble getting rid of them now, because they are just kicking off just silly amounts of revenue each year for the state that the politicians would either have to replace by cutting services and spending or have to raise some other kind of tax on people. So they've become a job engine too, right, for the people that are working there. So it's become very difficult to get rid of them because they're one of the few things that actually makes a lot of money for the government because the margins are pretty high on alcohol. So we still have a lot of states that have that. Really, again, there's not too many other similarities you can think of in other industries besides alcohol where we still have that model. And it has direct lineage to the post-prohibition era where this was kind of one of the two models that states chose. And then the other one was a licensing system, a three-tiered system, as I said. And you know, just to break it down more, again, you got the producers, the brewers, the winemakers, the distillers who are actually making the alcohol. And then it goes through the chain of distribution to get to the consumer. So there's a wholesaler level and then ultimately the retail stores where you buy it. And all those have to be separate. So that might not sound unique, but like, you know, consider, again, other industries like Apple. Apple makes a computer and then it sells it in its store. So it does everything. And it's a really great experience. I love going into Apple stores, like especially compared to the Virginia ABC. Like they're a great experience. You know that the person that's making the computer is the one that's selling you the computer. There's like this kind of vertical integration supply chain. It's a good experience. And you see that in most other industries. That really cannot happen in alcohol. So, you know, Budweiser can't in the same way operate a local beer shop or a bar, for example. A distiller, you know, with some exceptions, has a lot of trouble setting up kind of their own liquor store, for example.
And this is, in some ways, this is a response to pre-prohibition bar culture, where by the time prohibition happened, a very large percentage, I believe a majority of bars in the United States were what were known as tied bars, and that's T-I-E-D, which is to say they were tied directly to a beer maker, often partially owned or had some sort of deal for exclusivity, so you could carry only one brand of beer and not the others.
Yeah.
And so we are still kind of living with laws and systems that were designed to fight what politicians of the 1930s and 1920s thought were problems with 1900s and even 1800s era drinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, what were the breweries that survived Prohibition, right? They're the big ones because they could, a lot of them would make soda. They kind of switched product lines during Prohibition, made soda enough to keep the lights on. Prohibition got repealed and they're back in business. It's the small guys that got, you know, basically washed out, unsurprisingly. And so then, yeah, you have a lot of, you know, big brewers who were setting up bars or had exclusivity contracts, as you said, with bars where they had to only serve their beer. And so that was seen as very bad. We kind of imported this tied house law idea from England, actually, where they had a lot of similar things with pubs. And that kind of became the three-tiered system to kind of answer that problem. that doesn't really apply to today's beer market, let alone spirit market or wine market. You know, we, yes, there's still the big
markets
guys.
Evolve over 120 plus years, right? Like if they, things are a little bit different. It's not.
Yeah, no, it is.
You
know,
you can't, there's no place to tie your horse out front.
Right. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Which is a shame. So now we still have the Budweisers of the world and the Millers of the world and the big, you know, big brewers of the world, obviously. But we just have had this, of course, as everyone knows, explosion of all these small independent makers. And so, you know, no bar is going to be able to, even if they wanted to somehow have like an exclusivity contract with a mega macro brewer, like no bar is going to be able to get away with that today because everyone's going to demand the craft spirits.
And what bars now advertise is we have the biggest selection, right? That's you wouldn't want to lock yourself. No bar would, even if they had the opportunity to you, it's hard to imagine that a bar would want to lock themselves in. I mean, I guess you can sort of imagine those some tasting rooms, things like that, and maybe there's a market for it. Mm. But sort of, it would not be the kind of norm. It wouldn't overtake every corner pub.
Right.
I do sort of since you're talking about breweries, I want to ask you about something that I think sort of liquor and the alcohol nerds know, but other folks sort of don't think about, which is that, especially when it comes to public policy, there is often a kind of a low-key war between, maybe not even low-key, sometimes quite high-pitched, war between low ABV brewers of beer and high ABV, high alcohol brewers of spirits. And that these things in many states, even in many state control states, are regulated quite differently, often with much more strict regulations placed on liquor and distilled spirits. How did that come about? Why are those why do those laws exist? What's sort of the what's the thinking there?
Yeah, well, there's definitely this perception. I haven't fully traced the recent history of it. I've known more of kind of the early history, but there's kind of this perception that, that beer and wine are, you know, kind of softer and more like chill things to drink. Everyone, I guess, maybe envisions like their dad and mom would like crack open a beer and a wine or something like after work. And it's kind of always been viewed, or at least recently, not always, but it's recently been viewed in kind of a different lens, I think, as kind of distilled spirits and, you know, your traditional whiskeys and gins and vodkas of the world. And again, I think part of that is the potency. Just, you know, the you can have less of distilled spirits and obviously can have the same kind of alcohol content as a full beer. Although, you know, now we have these IPAs that are just like, you know, 20% ABV and stuff out there. So it's the gap's, I think, closed a lot, which also I think has a lot of policy ramifications for it. But I think that there's...
carbonated whiskey at that point.
It doesn't sound that appetizing, but there's in a lot of states you see this kind of bifurcation or treating you know hard spirits or distilled spirits differently than beer and wine or cider. For example, Virginia, I always pick on Virginia just because it's my backyard and I live there,
and because their alcohol laws are terrible.
Yeah, exactly, that's my life goal, to get Virginia ABC abolished, which is an ambitious goal, but good luck, man. Then I can retire. But Virginia's a good example of this. So they allow, you know, beer and wine to do a lot of things that spirits can't. I mean, one, beer and wine don't have to operate through the control system. In Virginia, you can go into a grocery store and buy beer. That's awesome for beer and wine makers in Virginia. And because of that, they aren't subject to the ridiculous markups that the Virginia ABC does on liquor. But even, you know, beyond just kind of the numbers crunching of it, things like tasting rooms, like, you know, in Virginia, it's really hard to go to a distillery and actually taste their product because they're limited by state law to only giving you 3 ounces of it. And as, you know, a fellow cocktail guy, you know, it's really hard to make a cocktail with when you only can give someone, you know, like 1 ounce for like kind of each, like they do mini cocktails, literally is what they do in Virginia because they have to. And you can go to, you know, all the great microbreweries in Virginia, and there's no limit on what they can give you beer-wise. And again, some of these, you know, IPAs are pretty damn strong. So if you have a lot of them, they can't overserve like bars, but you know, still they aren't kind of limited in the same way. And so there's definitely this tension between a lot of the beer and wine interests and distilled spirits makers. And a lot of times it's you know, the whole it could be like beer wholesalers, for example, in Virginia are really vested in making sure that the laws stay the same way because they want to make sure the product that they carry, that they stock, beer, is kind of, you know, more operating in a free market, and then their direct substitute good competitor, what they view at least is that the distilled spirits can't operate in the same way. So yeah, that kind of is a theme, I guess, across a lot of alcohol regimes.
So let's talk a little bit about your report, which I think covers at least one law in Virginia. You have put together this report on the 12 dumbest alcohol laws in America.
Right.
I want to just ask you sort of about the origins and about how you did this. We've been talking for, I don't know, half an hour here.
Yeah.
And we haven't even actually gone over any of the specific laws.
It's true.
It sounds... Do you have a spreadsheet of 150 dumb alcohol laws? Did you like come up with like a big pile of them and like whittle this down? How was this sort of put together, and how did you decide which 12 would make the final cut?
Yeah, so we kind of crowdsourced it old-fashioned way. We come across a lot of the stuff when you do what we do. Me and my colleague Kevin was come across the stuff, so we would just save it casually. But then we kind of got a little more organized about it. I give a shout out to the wonderful intern Daniel DeLoretto, who really did a lot of like the legwork of kind of like, basically emailing a ton of people that we knew that worked in the drinks industry themselves. And it's like, what laws annoy you the most? And then, news sources and Google searches and books. There's been some books that have been written about, like a field guide to like drinking and like X Place. And some of those have weird laws in them. So we aggregated all these laws together. We wanted to make it fun. I mean, we thought about, maybe attaching like a methodology to it or something like that. But we're like, we wanted more use this as a way to kind of message to people that things are really screwed up and that we kind of need to go back to first principles and rethink how we're regulating alcohol in America. So we kind of just picked the ones that we ran across the most, or that there was kind of the most frustration on, or the ones that were the most difficult to repeal over time. Indiana's warm beer law, for example, like every year, like they're like all excited and they're going to go to the Capitol and get rid of it and allow gas stations to sell refrigerated beer.
So
what
and
never happens.
Indiana's warm beer law? Like, tell us about that. Tell us why it exists.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah. So Indiana,
least
Indiana,
favorites.
Yeah, right, right. Well, favorite is like an absurd example. And I guess it's bad for freedom, but good for business, I guess, for what I do. But Indiana, gas stations or convenience stores can't sell refrigerated beer, so they literally cannot put beer in a refrigerated cooler, unlike every other state in the country.
Can you put ice? Could you like just like have a big like a big ice bucket and have people pull them out that way, like to avoid the?
I don't think
technically
they can,
we're not using mechanical refrigeration.
Yes, I don't think they can do that. But what they have started doing, and of course, there's always attempts to get workarounds here. So the latest workaround, which has worked so far, is they have these like disposable like bags that you can like put ice in and then put the warm beer in right at the store, and apparently it like chills it within 15 minutes. I've never tried one.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah, right. It's just crazy, and obviously that adds to the cost
of
the beer and yada yada.
That is a market failure. That market should not exist.
Right. Yes,
it is
exactly.
Entirely a government created. Yeah. Workaround market.
Yeah, I mean, apologies to the people that are making those bags. I guess it was a very smart idea, but it's something that probably really we shouldn't need. That's just an example of a licensing system in Indiana. As I said, there's the kind of three tiers of licenses, and then even amongst the different levels, like retail, there's different kinds of retail licenses. So liquor stores that have liquor licenses in Indiana, they can sell cold beer, and this kind of stasis and momentum is kept it that way because they don't want to share that with the gas stations and convenience stores, because why would they, right? The only place you can get cold beer is through them. So, Indiana's warm beer laws are kind of a classic example of something that's morphed over time but traces its lineage to the post-prohibition era. And I think is a good kind of a messaging tool, which is why we did the report, to show kind of the unintended consequences of bad policy, and especially outdated bad policy.
So another one that you list is Idaho's ban on infused liquor.
Right.
Explain that one to me. What does that mean exactly, and why is that prohibited?
Yeah, so basically the way their law is written is that you can't basically add things or flavors to a bottle of alcohol. And the idea, what they were worried about, which is actually something that is, to be fair, very prevalent in some other countries. You see, again, from like Russia, you read news stories about them like taking Smirnoff bottles, like pouring them out, and then like putting just like some rot gut, like dangerous stuff in it, and then selling it to Smirnoff. So I think that they were worried about like tampering from bars and like what you see in the movies where they're watering down the vodka, stuff like that. It's like whether that was actually happening or not, they couldn't point to any examples of that happening. And also there's probably a way to write a law that actually does that versus being so broadly worded that's like you can't add anything, which then gets you into like you can't do, vodka infused with vanilla beans. You can't do, a whiskey that's been infused with, cinnamon sticks or something. something to make like a fireball type thing. So obviously that really makes it hard to do cool craft cocktails because so much of cocktail culture is built on each component of the drink and each component having its own complexity and then bringing it together and kind of creating a perfect marriage of a cocktail. So yeah, that's one that I think is an example of one that's particularly incongruous with the modern craft spirits like world that we live in, which is kind of living in this like era of experimentation.
This is a point that I like to make sort of as somebody who comes at this from a cocktail-focused perspective, which is that these laws don't just restrict access to people who want to drink who want to drink every now and then. What they restrict in many cases is creativity.
Yes.
And they make drinking worse.
Yep.
And so I actually want to follow up on that. Is that restriction on infusion, does that only count for retail establishments or does that count at home? Because I do infusions. I make a holiday cocktail with a apple pear cinnamon infused brandy.
Yeah.
That's super delicious. And
why
don't
you bring some
ginger syrup?
it's
in progress right
okay,
now.
I gotcha.
But I mean, I've got a bottle of infused. Yeah. I've probably got a dozen bottles of infused brandy and whiskey at home with different sort of stuff that I like to play around. I mean, I imagine that there are not raids on individual houses where you've got a bunch of unmarked bottles, but is it technically illegal in Idaho to do that on your own?
So my understanding is that it was with the retail level bars, and they did raid bars though. So I mean, you know, and so yeah, I think that you know at home if you're making your own thing, like you'll be fine, and I don't think there's a law against that per se. But it still like you know impacts people that that go to bars to drink, obviously. And the idea that you're raiding bars for you know putting some kind of infusion in a drink or barrel aged cocktails, again, can depending on how you interpret the law, can run afoul of it. So it's pretty wild that we have that in 2018 America, but we do.
So another one that restricts, I think, people's ability to get good drinks is in your home state of Virginia, which has a ratio law. Now that's not, sadly, a restriction on making your Negronis at the proper ratio, which I have many thoughts about, but we won't get into today. Instead, that's a ratio of food sales to alcohol sales.
Yeah.
And what that does is that it makes it very hard to run craft cocktail-specific bars.
Right.
So why is that? Sort of how does that business model end up in conflict with that particular restriction?
Yeah, the Virginia's ratio is crazy. It basically says you need to sell $45 in food for every $55 in distilled spirits. You sell beer and wine, arbitrarily exempted. Another example of them being treated differently. And the concern, as always, is that people will go to places or bars will cater to people who only want to drink and that they should serve them some food so they have a base in their stomach so they're not getting rolling drunk. Even though next door neighbors, D.C. and Maryland, don't have the law and it's fine. So what that ends up doing is that it makes it almost impossible to run, a cocktail, like a high-end cocktail bar or, a high-end whiskey bar, martini lounges, like with jazz clubs and stuff can run into that because a lot of those places don't serve food or if they do, it's, really kind of minor, like finger food. And the drinks are like often $15 to $20. So it's really hard to kind of make that work in your budget. That's why almost every craft cocktail bar in Virginia either also operates as a restaurant or is actually under an umbrella company which also owns a food joint. So you see that a lot in Alexandria, for example, which is where I used to live, and then also where I presently am in Richmond. Almost every place that's a cocktail bar is also like serving like full scale food restaurant, and a lot of places don't want to do that, right? I mean, like the great mixologists of the world oftentimes just want to be able to make like really great drinks because that's their specialty. They're not also a chef.
So. And a lot of the world's best cocktail bars, the places that are the most innovative, the most focused on this, these are sort of the places that I try to go whenever I travel. Like that's what I do.
Right.
So, is that I go and I look at lists of here's the city's best cocktail bars, and I try to keep up with this stuff. And when I go to New York or when I go to LA or when I go to Austin, I try to go to these places.
Yeah.
And the majority, not all, but the majority of them will serve a little bit of food.
Right,
at most, maybe a grilled cheese, but often just sort of nuts and olives. And but you're there for the drinks, and you're there. They are often sort of pre-dinner or post-dinner experiences, and designed to be that way.
Right.
They are sort of, and so what they're prohibiting here basically is a sort of cocktail specialization.
Yes.
You can do that at the bar at your restaurant, but it is a way of making specialization, which is how you get the sort of the most refined products.
Yep.
It is a way of making that specialization illegal. So I want to talk just about one more of these to take it back to the beginning of our conversation.
Yes.
You mentioned Andrew Jackson signing a law banning distilleries in Native American lands early on in our conversation. And this is, in fact, this restriction on prohibiting distilleries on Native American lands is the number one item in your list. So can you tell us a little bit about that, about the history?
Yeah.
Obviously, this sort of comes back to not quite to immigrants, but sort of the fear of the other, sort of people who aren't like you, and kind of tie all of this together for us, if you can.
Yeah, this actually ties together well, because this is a breaking news alert here, but actually Congress just finally passed the Senate and the House a bill to repeal that law. Actually, it's going to the president's desk and expected to be signed. So we like to think we get results at our street. So the number one, we got that one checked off, and now we'll move on to number two and three, hopefully. But yeah, this law was a 1934 laws during the era where our federal government was trying
1834?
I'm sorry, yes, 1834. Thank you.
Make sure I'm...
Yeah, no, you're right. During the era where our federal government was trying to manage what they called at the time the quote-unquote Indian problem, and that had a lot of dimensions to it, of course, and including a lot of unsavory ones in our nation's history. Part of that, a feature of that, was this perception that Native American populations kind of couldn't handle their alcohol. They called it the myth of the drunken Indian, that just, you know, couldn't manage alcohol, couldn't be responsible with it in the way that, you know, kind of the white man was, you know, again, scare quotes. It was one feature of a series of paternalistic policy laws that were passed. And so they basically tried to outlaw booze from being manufactured or sold or traded on Indian Native American reservations during the time. And so, as I said earlier, it didn't really work at all, because the white settlers and also the U.S. soldiers themselves who were stationed on the reservations had booze and freely traded it in violation of it to the Native Americans. So it didn't work. But anyways, what was really interesting is you fast forward several decades. There was, you know, federal national prohibition, of course. No one could then have alcohol. That was repealed, but it still took another two decades, to 1953, to get rid of prohibition on Native American reservations. And even when that happened in 1953, I have not been able to trace whether it was a mistake or whether it was purposeful. It was in a different part of the statute, but the distilling ban, the actual making the spirits, that part of the law, that early law, stayed intact and has stayed on the books since then. So, you know, today, and there was a tribe in Washington State that tried to create its own craft spirits to sell on its reservation to people that came to its casino, and they were pointed gently to this law by the Bureau of Indian Affairs that was still on the books. And so they were the ones that kind of highlighted it and got a congressman to run a bill for it. But it was amazing, and it really tells a lot of the story of America's relationship with alcohol. Again, there was kind of this dimension of the other and different populations not being able to handle their alcohol, like you saw at the national level of prohibition. They actually, you know, again, it was a baby experiment with prohibition, and then it's failed spectacularly, like national prohibition did, and then it's kind of something that has stayed with us at a momentum till 2018 in a lot of the way that the after effects of prohibition have. So it's kind of a microcosm, really, I think, of how our government and alcohol have kind of always had this difficult, I guess you'd call, complicated relationship with each other. But at least it's should be off the books here in the next couple of days.
It sounds like a lot of historical bad news that is finally starting to turn into good news.
Yeah.
So since we are here for Repeal Day, I at least am going to recommend that everybody finish their day with a drink. And I want to ask you, what do you recommend that people drink this evening to celebrate the repeal of prohibition?
feel like it might be kind of fun to go pre-prohibition. At least I believe you might answer this better than me, but I've really been into the Boulevardier recently. It's a really solid cocktail. I think that's a pre-prohibition drink. Is that right?
So it's a Negroni variation, right, basically made with bourbon, sometimes with rye as the base instead of gin. Yeah. I make a couple of variations. I had one last night.
Nice. Yeah. No, it's a great cocktail. I've been digging it recently. So if people are out of the bars, I'd recommend that one.
Great. And I'm going to recommend that people sip a little bit of John Fitzgerald Larceny Bourbon, which is a weeded bourbon, quite actually similar to Pappy Van Winkle.
Nice.
And it is named after a federal prohibition agent who used his keys to dip to the federal storehouses to dip into the stash and get the good stuff for himself, because that's nice. How prohibition works.
Right, exactly.
And that's why it's a good thing we don't have it anymore. This has been fascinating talking with you today. I want to encourage everyone to go download and read your report on America's dumbest drinking laws. Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote it up in Reasons Roundup this morning, but you can also download the report from the R Street Institute. Thank you very much for talking with us today, and happy repeal day, everyone.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.